Good morning, good evening, depending upon what part of the world you're in. If it's Friday, you know it is the CEO series where we bring together the most interesting people from across the globe. Our guest today is Jeanette Jordan, who is an executive coach and a strategic business consultant who advises the C-suite and founders. She's based in California, so she's up a little early for us, which we really appreciate. Before joining the tech industry, she worked as an engineer and construction manager until the financial crisis, and that was the pivot that she made, and we're gonna talk through that. And our topic is reflect, recover, and recognize the career opportunity. That's the starting point. So let's get started. Talk to us, share your career journey and how that pivot, because of the financial crisis, you were able to make that U-turn and do what you're doing now.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ron. It's such a pleasure to be here. As you mentioned, I started my career in civil engineering and construction management, and that is like what I wanted to do since I was a kid. I used to play with Legos, and I actually used to build buildings out of my Legos. And so like any great type A person, I was really focused on making that my dream. And so it was really hard when I was working on a project. I realized we were building through all of the houses and properties that we had sold. We weren't making new sales, right? Supply and demand. I knew that we were going out of business. And I had to do something else. And I didn't have really any other dreams. Thankfully, I had already enrolled in business school because I wanted to become a better manager. In my engineering career didn't really allow me to study people management. And so I used being in business school to kind of make that first hard pivot. And what I learned from my very first career coach at this moment was how to actually think about my skill set and how I might be able to reapply that to a new industry.
That's pretty cool to make that realization, because a lot of people would have looked at that as kind of a, I don't want to say dead end, but how do I get started again? How do I go back and find it? The other job that I used to have, and that job wasn't there.
Yeah, I mean, and we're seeing some of that now, right? Because with the layoff, it's often a signal that an industry is changing, right? An industry is being impacted. I could have gone and gotten a similar job, but did I really have any kind of security or long-time viability in that job? And so I chose to think about how I could take the same skill set and maybe reimagine it and reapply it.
Okay. So that's cool. So from that technical skills, mm-hmm. And then you went back to school and picked up, I'm going to say, soft skills.
Yeah, softer skills.
Softer skills. And then now you're in executive coaching. That's a leap.
Yeah. Well, so here's the thing. One of the things that I discovered is what I like to do, right? And so what I like to do actually has to do with working collaboratively, right? I did that on a construction site, coordinating all of the trades, right? I did that in my actual technology and marketing career, coordinating, you know, engineering, marketing, legal, all of these people to get a project launched. And as a coach, I actually work with leaders on that same kind of orchestration within their companies, right? So I think knowing your values, knowing your skill set, knowing how you like to contribute, I think so often we think about our career being tied to a title, being tied to an industry, whereas some of the work that I do in my coaching is really helping people understand their values and skill sets. And those things, right, can be called many different things. But how we want to actually apply them and contribute is what is most important. And it's a hard lesson. I'm not going to pull any punches, right? Losing a job, layoff. There is grief. There is loss. There is sadness in it. Yeah. But as you are moving through that, there's also an opportunity, right, to see and reimagine what can come next. And I have done that in my career, right, out of necessity, because we have moved in and out of these very volatile markets. And so how do you start thinking about what's coming instead of just what is?
You know, as you talk through the manager construction site and the different entities you're dealing with, it's the same in business. I mean, collaborating in business. And we use a metaphor when we do leadership development called a symphonic C-suite. And that's based on looking at a department as an instrument and how do you create that orchestra mix in doing that. But, you know, what I find amazing is that to have the clarity to think through that when you're dealing with grief. I say grief as in losing the job and realizing there could be a pivot. How do I take this over? That's an innate skill because a lot of folks don't have that.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think it's a learned skill, right? I had great coaches to help me guide me through learning that skill. And one of the things that I do in my practice is often I like to do some worksheets and practical exercises to help people move through the grief because in a time of change and a time of layoff, so much is out of your control. So sometimes thinking about practical things that you can touch that are tangible that you can do makes us feel at least give us the illusion of control, which can make us start to feel safe as we're navigating very uncertain times.
Yeah. I remember reading an article during that time, 2008, 2009, Greenwich, Connecticut. You're aware of Greenwich, Connecticut, very high income area. And a church there decided to put together a group, a healing group for people, executives who'd lost their jobs. And the priest or the minister, whoever it was, wrote a paper on it. And he said what he found that was a little sad was that the people that were going through this grief, when they lost the initials after their name, they were no longer EVP, CEO, whatever it is. That was the greatest loss because now they were dealing with themselves without all the flowery stuff that goes around that. And I'm like, wow, what a great observation. Because we get hooked on this power trip with these, I call it the initials. We get the initials and everything changes.
Yeah, I think that it becomes an opportunity to rediscover yourself, right? And I know I had that moment, you know, we talked about my initial pivot, but, you know, after a decade in tech, I burned out and I talked really openly about that. And I took a sabbatical and I remember having an executive coach when I was on a sabbatical and I was like, okay, whip me into shape. What's next? And she lovingly was like, you need to take a break. You need to be interesting. You need to rediscover your hobbies. And I'm like, what does this have to do with my career? And I remember registering for a networking event and it said title and I froze. And I was like, does that mean I could go? Who am I? What is my title? I am off of work. What does that mean? And I had a bit of an identity crisis. So I do think that loss of title is real. And I don't think we actually deal with that enough as a grief. Mm-hmm. You know, losing a job is kind of one of the top five griefs that we will deal with. And unfortunately, in these volatile times, it's become pretty common for it to happen every few years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's going to change now that, you know, we're talking about the realization of post-COVID? And people are kind of rethinking jobs, mindfulness, and all these things are coming into play now. I tend to feel that it's moving away from that. People are going to start pursuing, within reason, something that they really get a kick out of doing, get a kick out of getting up in the morning and going to do that without putting themselves through the stress that they would have years past.
Yeah, I think that we are seeing whatever you want to call it, the emergence of kind of the gig economy or the portfolio career. I think we are going to see much more people doing multiple things for a while we're in this time of change and transition. I think the new market, the thing that is going to be predominant for the next 10 years is yet to kind of emerge. And so while we're in this time of change, I think both companies and I think both individuals are going to be dabbling and figuring it out a bit. We still have to see what this emergence of AI is going to do and how it's going to impact the future of work. And unfortunately, I think we're going to see some more job loss due to it. And I think we're going to see some new jobs emerge due to it.
Yeah, I just, you know, whenever I'm working online, I always keep the business news on. And I see that T-Mobile announced today 5,000 people are going to lose their job in telecom. I didn't see anything else as it relates to telecom jobs. But if I'm in telecom working for Verizon, whoever it is, all of that thought is coming through there. And I'm going to work and I'm thinking, am I going to be next? And this is why I say, I think they are going to start thinking through from a higher context as to what their future is going to look like.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just talking about this last night. I also think, kind of with the trend in the rise in AI, we're also going to see more human connection things emerge, right? Things that cannot be necessarily automated and outsourced. And so I do think you're right. Not only are individuals going to tap in to much more of what they want to be doing, being conscious, mind, body, and spirit, but I also think that the jobs that are still going to require humans are going to be much more tapped in to human emotion and connection.
One of the other thoughts is that I remember reading an article about the new C-suite, the new C-suite that understands this, what we're talking about now, and trying to make their, and I'm not talking about a happy place to work, but I mean people enjoying what they're doing. That's more about the camaraderie and teamwork, really about it, as opposed to some superficial offsite and come back and after 2 days you're right back into the same mess you were in before.
Yeah, no, I think, listen, one of the reasons why I am an executive coach is because I want everybody to be happy and healthy at work. We spend so much time at work, and you think about like something like dating, billions of dollars of industry that we spend time and intention on trying to pick and find the right partner. We spend a fraction of that on trying to pick the right workplace. Yet, when you look at the data, especially for me in the US, we spend the most time at work. Right. And so how do we start to bring some of that intention into picking our coworkers and our workplaces?
I just read a book, Dying for a Job. You have to read it.
Oh, I'm gonna look this up.
And you know what one of the findings that came back to me was that there's more heart attacks on Monday than any day of the week. And so the discussion was about Sunday night angst. And when I tell that story here, I talk about Saturday night angst, because Sunday is, well, it used to be, Sunday was the beginning of the week. People stressing over going to deal with what they would have to deal with on Monday, to put on this mask and go through and appear to be happy, pleased, and all that, and hating every minute of it.
And you know what? It was so stark. My partner is actually an engineer, really in the data and everything. So we were just on vacation last week, and he was monitoring his heart rate. And so hiking up a mountain, his heart rate was actually lower than coming back home and sitting still. Right. And so I think it tells you something about the pace and the angst that can just kind of happen as you are thinking and anticipating work. And I think this is the opportunity, right? In a world where we do have more data, I think that this is an opportunity for us to start to actually be aware of some of these triggers and find the right support team to help us navigate what is making us happy, what is making us tick in a positive way, what is lighting our fire, and it's also what are the negative signals that are coming off, because it is impacting our health, not only our physical health, but our mental and our emotional health.
When I read your bio and I was reading background on you, and I saw the 2008 and how that was a turning point, because I had a situation in my career was the same, but mine was just that I didn't want to do it anymore. The Sunday night angst was just too much. And I was sitting in my backyard and I said, you know what? I'm going to resign. I'm going to resign tomorrow. And I went and I resigned. I didn't have a job, anything like that. And people were saying, oh my God, you're going to walk away from this big job. All of a sudden, I said, I don't want to do it anymore. I'll figure it out. And took some time off to try and figure it out. But when I look back on my career, if I would not have made that pivot, I would not be doing the interesting work I do. I don't have Sunday night angst anymore. I don't have Saturday night angst anymore, because I enjoy what I do, and I'm here in this country. I've got to leave my hotel to get on a flight to fly back to Dubai or whatever it is. That's not work for me. I enjoy it.
I feel the same way about moving into coaching full time. And I want everybody to feel the same way, right? I don't think that we are meant to be here to be unhappy and to feel like we are suffering, right? And so, where is the intersection? One of my favorite books when I was in a time of transition is The Crossroads of Should and Must. If you haven't read it, I think it's a great one. And she really talks about being at a high tech job and one day just snapping and being like, I want to quit. I'm an artist. And so she moved to a blank apartment and just started painting and seeing what comes from that. And I think that there's an opportunity at the intersection of both what you're passionate and good at and how you want to make money and build your lifestyle.
Yeah. You talked about, you know, you were telling your coach and you were ready to get back and the coach was telling you, just breathe, just calm down with this. And when I made this transition, my family had a summer home on Myrtle Beach. Mm-hmm. And I drove down there and every morning I'd get up with a chair and I'd go sit out in near the ocean and waves were coming in. And I'd sit there sometime for 4 or 5 hours, not reading anything, just sitting there looking and thinking, listening. And it was the best time ever.
Yeah. I think creativity comes in the white space.
Yeah. So what can organizations do to enable people to get into that space? I mean, you don't want your star people to leave, but how can we, is flexibility going to solve it? You design your own work schedule. Because I look at some of the announcements that's coming out, Zoom. Okay, now we want you back 2 days a week, but you're Zoom. Yeah. You're supposed to be Zoom and everybody's using you. And if you can't handle it, so what do you think about the other companies?
I found that so amazing
the other day when they made that announcement.
Yeah, I think we're waiting for some new models to emerge, right? Like, and there's a tension, right? And I see it, especially someone who coaches founders and leaders, right? I said it before, I think that there's no replacement for human connection. And I think people are trying to find the right time and cadence for how do I get people together to mix and mingle? Because a lot of the coaching I do with leaders in remote worlds, they're still struggling to foster connection, to be more vulnerable in the virtual world. They feel like it just has to be transactional. We need to meet and shut our laptop. And so I think it's going to be a re-education and debunking some of those myths for people to start figuring out what are some of those new models for us to still build connection and community, even in a remote world. So I think because people don't have it figured out, we're kind of going back and forth, or are we in person? Are we not in person? But to your earlier question, I think that there needs to be an emergence of a couple of things. I think I saw it was like Calendly or somebody had a new feature that actually added the cost of everybody who's in this meeting, right? You know, we know for a long time there's kind of been death by meeting culture. And I think that we need to give some more space internally for people to be able to think, innovate, do work at work kind of things. And so how can we actually start to think about optimizing our calendars and our schedules to say, is this meeting really important? What is the actual goal and outcome? How is everyone feeling as a result of this, you know, and how can we also leave some more space for thinking and innovation? I often coach people, whether it's a half a day, whether it's a couple hours in the morning, whether you can actually do a no meeting day, you need to clear that space and have some thinking time in your day, in your week. It is crucial, especially for leaders at the highest level.
I'm laughing because of the fact that, so I have this Google alert and it monitors my calendar and I get up in the morning and I know I have a free day, but there's something about seeing that email that says, your day is clear. There's nothing on the calendar.
Yes.
I knew it was there, but just that notice kind of like reinvigorates me because I have a free day. So what about, I have things to do, but I'm just like, oh, thank you so much.
Not only that, I want people to pay attention to how do you actually feel and attack your work the day after that day, right? After you've had some breathing room, the kind of energy that comes in for you to actually get after it is what is important.
When I was in Saudi Arabia and there was one of the executives, we had this meeting every week and the founder called a meeting to try and solve some Mickey Mouse issue that could have been done. And everyone was sitting in there and one of the older dudes was sitting there. He was like tapping his pencil. He said, you know what? This is the most expensive meeting for 1 hour to solve this Mickey Mouse issue.
Yeah.
You know, I thought of that. So I said, I went back to my office and I pulled the numbers and I calculated the hourly rate of everybody sitting in there. It was astronomical with 8 executives sitting around trying to figure out a meeting that they could have, 2 or 3 people over email could have solved it.
Yeah, definitely. I think we need to do more of that. And like I said, also leaving space, I was sharing with one of my clients the concept of like the human call, right? I think it was Simon Sinek was talking about how are we actually leaving space because we don't run into each other in the hallway, because we don't have that human connection. How are we leaving space for that? Because part of the resistance is you can be mean and you can stonewall people and you cannot get things done when you don't have to see them and you don't have to run into them. So it's really, really important to still build those relationships so that we can work together effectively and efficiently.
So, you know, I read every article when a company announces that they want everybody to go back. And I'm always kind of intrigued by how the founder gives the why behind it. Mm. And one of the things that stood out for me, Jamie Dimon, who's the chairman of the board, CEO for JP Morgan, and they've just built this huge building on Park Avenue, and they want everybody to the building was built during COVID. They want everybody to come back there, same as Apple built this new headquarters, Meta built this new headquarters. And he said, well, you know, I think it would be best if everybody comes back, because just standing around a water cooler and talking strategy. And I'm thinking, I've stood around a water cooler for years and there was never strategy. It was all gossip. Maybe your water cooler is different than mine, but I don't remember strategy being discussed there.
Mine was more, what are you watching on TV? And given the writer's strike, I don't know if that's going to be interesting water cooler talk for a while.
Interesting water cooler. But again, so let's take that a different angle, because when I look at a CEO who grew his career from coming in and going through the steps from the cubicle to the office, to the bigger office, to the corner office, to the C-suite, that's how you grew your career. And you're saying we need to get back to that because I want you to grow your career like that. But think of a younger worker who grew up in COVID, started working in COVID, and has always been online, has grown up in a digital era. Their concept could be totally different than the CEO gives the business case, and it's not strong enough as to why we should come back.
I'm going to reframe that. I think it's slightly different. I don't think it's that they want people to grow their career in the same way. I think that what we've seen historically, right, is raises, promotion, good projects have actually not been fairly distributed, right? It's who do you know and who's giving FaceTime and who's building that confidence and who's building internal stakeholders. And I don't think because there has been objective and quantitative measures enough for some of these things, people do not know how to actually grow people's career in this remote environment. And they are holding on to what feels familiar to them, that crutch of who's giving the FaceTime, who's showing me that they want to stay an hour late. I think that this is going to be a call and a movement for us to move to some more objective and measurable metrics for how we start to get raises and promotions. And I think that this is a good thing. I think that we won't have these biases that go towards extroverts. I don't think we will have the biases to people who are just being present. And now we can start to more fairly evaluate people's actual contribution and impact.
I want to acknowledge some people here. Ted Souter is good morning from Chicago. Hey, Ted, how are you? Thanks for listening in. And Connie Jacobs-Walton from Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you for being a guest. I mean, thank you for listening in on the show. Do you think that the younger generation will figure it out? Because here's another article I read that said as a C-suite skews younger, you'll find a different interpretation of what it means to work. If they, you know, so you talk about the COVID experience as you're growing, what is going to be different when you get in that seat and try and drive a company towards success, whatever it is?
I think we're going to find a new normal. I think we're seeing a lot of pushback and backlash to the way things have been. You know, we've often talked about the great resignation and the great reshuffle in the time of COVID. I do think that there's going to be probably a balance, right? I think that, listen, to make progress and change, you sometimes need force as strong in the opposite direction as it's been in. But I think what can be a result of that is a neutral. I do think that the future is probably going to be hybrid. I don't think all in person is bad. Now, whether we see that be monthly, whether we see that be quarterly, at some point, I think we will need to get humans together to engage and build relationships. But I do think that the future is going to be much more asynchronous, not rooted to a specific location. And I think we're going to see this across all fronts. You know, my oldest daughter started kindergarten in COVID on an iPad. Do you think 20 years from now, she is going to want to be rooted in a lecture hall or rooted in a cubicle learning? She learned at an early age that learning is not tied to location. And so this is the future we have to prepare for.
You know, you talk about the iPad, because I saw a meme online and was talking about that. It showed back in the day, you know, go to school at first and you've got like 5 or 6 books you're carrying like this. And then they show the kid come to school and all of this is just an iPad.
Yeah.
So how does education, when we look at that, so every industry, so for the most part, is going through this transition. The education sector is going to have to change, because it's not the way that it used to be with the books and all these kind of things. And then when you look at all the new things that are coming out, the AI and all of this, because one of the things I thought about, you know, it's something as simple as teaching history. And you were talking about, you know, the fountain in Rome and all these kinds of things. Immersion, and I can see it, versus in the book. And we're discussing that in the book.
Exactly. I do think education is going to change, and I think we're going to be confronted with that. I think ChatGPT is going to be one of these things that's going to really push education to say, what side of the aisle are you on? And I am hopeful and prayerful that they're going to be on the side of allowing AI, right? I do think it's the new calculator as a metaphor, Google search engine or whatever it is. I think that this is the future. So the best thing that we can do is start to empower young people to know how to use it, to think about showing their work or their prompts. Yeah. But this is going to be a time where you have to decide, listen, education, whether people like to say it or not, are often run like businesses. They have measurement and they have impact. And one of those is thinking about how they are progressing either students to the next school or to get a job. If the future is going to be using these technology tools, then they need to start preparing and training for them, or I think that they're going to start losing ground. So I do think that we are going to see a time where education, I also think healthcare and health tech, right? Yeah. There's been a dragging of a feet of digitizing records and stuff like that. Telemedicine that we saw have a rise in COVID. I do think that these are two industries that have been allowed to kind of laggard for a while that are now going to be hit with, you're going to need to innovate or you're going to start to become irrelevant.
You know, you mentioned the calculator, and I saw online the other day when they're talking about ChatGPT, and they showed, I don't know whether it was doctorate or what, but they showed a group of professors, educators who were picketing because they didn't want kids to bring calculators in the classroom.
Wow.
Yeah, because they didn't want that, because this is going to disrupt. They need to learn how, you know, the timetables you had to learn, all those kind of things. And I'm thinking it's the same thing. Just calm down and figure out how we can work with it. But I guess sometimes when I see the articles about the dangers, I said, I don't want to read no dangers, because I'm using it and it's cool for me. So maybe you put some restrictions around it. Maybe you educate people more about it, but stop trying to figure out everything and you want to block it and give me a break.
I want it to become the elimination of busy work, right? If ChatGPT can do it, was it truly a measure of our intelligence, our level of learning, or our intellect in the first place?
I read your article, 5 Common Mistakes to Avoid When Making the Career Transition. I couldn't wait to get to this. So give us the 5. Give us the secret.
Yeah. So, you know, listen, after a decade of coaching and also being a hiring manager, some of the things that I see over and over again, number one on my list is I am open to anything, right? I think one of my coaches that I love used to always say, niches make riches, right? I'm open to anything. It's just signaling you have not thought deeply about what you want to do next. You have not done the work to make a specific ask. I know people think it's good and it makes you flexible, and it doesn't. It really makes you feel unclear, right? I often love to use dating analogies, right? And so I'm like, listen, if you went on a date and you're like, why did you select me? And somebody's like, because I'm open to anything. How would that make you feel, right? And so when you are in a professional context, people want to feel special. People want to feel wooed. And so you need to come up with some very specific reasons of why you're pursuing an industry, a job function, a company. So I would say that's number one on my list. I think having unrealistic targets, right? Yes, we would all love to be CEO of this or CXO and make $350,000, right? But if you have never managed people, if you only have 3 years of experience, some of these things are not realistic. So do your research and start thinking about, for your level of experience, what is a reasonable title and what is a reasonable salary? If you're going to be a business leader, doing market research and understanding pricing and competition is key, and it's no different when it comes to your career. So that would be my number two. I say number three is using the same resume for every role. Again, I think this comes back to courting and making people feel special. One, you should be looking at that job description and doing a job description dissection. What are they specifically asking for? And what can you specifically speak to that they're asking for? And you need to do some tailoring. And again, tying back to our previous conversation, this is something that ChatGPT is actually great at helping you with. And I coach a couple of founders with startups to help you customize those resumes and cover letters, right? So, you know, use AI, superpower your job search and use the tools that are available. So I would say that that is number three. Number four, and I saw this crisply as a hiring manager, applying for too many jobs at the same company. Especially if they have different job functions. I have seen people like, oh, here is a BD role, here is a marketing role, here's a project manager role. See, mistake number one, you're signaling I am open to anything and I really haven't mastered anything. And then number five, and I do think that this is one of the most important, not asking for help. I talk to a lot of people searching and they're like, I've submitted 250 resumes. And I'm like, how many referrals have you gotten? Zero. You know, I do think that referrals go a long way. And some companies, especially if you're thinking about big tech companies, the Googles, the Metas of the world, you're in a whole different review pile by having a referral. So it's really important that through the process, you actually build really strong relationships and you ask for help. And hopefully you've started to build strong relationships before you needed help. But it's really important to ask for help, have those informational interviews, have the referrals, have references set up. There's so many people, I get panicked emails. Can you talk to somebody tomorrow or in 2 or 4 hours to be my referral? You have to be really respectful of people's time. You have to prep them in advance. So don't only ask for a referral, get your references lined up in anticipation that you're going to be successful in your search.
So many cool of the five. I want to recognize John Self, who was our guest on last week, and as well as Jacob. He's been in education for two decades and believe that education could be a bit more challenging for the change. And John says that you're spot on. A banker in Australia told her employees to return to the office for their mental health. there was a lot of pushback as it relates to that. So the other point that you mentioned there is that relationships or referrals are just sending things out, and somebody, people will send me, I get so many of these, you know, as soon as you connect with someone, they say, can you help and find me a job? I don't even know who you are, number one. I don't know what you do, what your area of expertise is, but I'll always see, I'm the type of person, I will always respond. I will say, maybe you should rethink the way that you do this. You should maybe think through looking at somebody's background and talk about and try and sell yourself. Here's what I'm good at. Here's my expertise or whatever. But to say, give me a job. Nobody gives anybody a job. And someone was telling me, why do you waste time doing that? And I said, you know what? Because it may help somebody.
And hopefully it will. And feedback's a gift, you know, and I want to send this message clearly for anybody who's in transition, right? I know I've done it as a hiring manager and given people feedback, and people don't always take it well. I remember one person sent me back an email and said, sorry for your loss, right? And I was like, when you're in a place of needing help, and we will all be there at some point, what you can do is be really gracious, because feedback is a gift. Somebody took time out of your schedule. I saw a VC also post that he turned someone down and the founder just totally lost it and went off. And listen, it is a very small world. Our paths may cross again. You never know who anybody knows. So you should be really gracious and thankful when somebody actually takes time out of their busy schedule to give you feedback that you can apply to the next job, to the next outreach, to the next round.
One gentleman who I won't name responded to me in such a way. I thought I was going to need security to go outside. Who you think you're this, you think you're that. I know people like you. You're this, you that. And he just went on and on and on. And when he finished, I said, my man, I said, do me a favor, learn how to take feedback. I said, I was just giving you my honest opinion of whatever it was, but I wish you a good life. I hope you land wherever you land. And if he's listening, this is you, and you know the conversation we had. But it became so brutal that I'm thinking, well, I'm glad I'm in Dubai, because if I was in New York, this guy would probably try and look me up. I mean, he went on a diatribe and just talking about, because I didn't respond the way he wanted to respond. But one of the things you mentioned, there was a great book out that said feedback is a gift.
Yeah.
And trying is a gift. Feedback is a gift, and trying to understand that. So how do you stay focused? I mean, you leave out and you're giving all of this great advice and all of this. You're coming back in. How do you say, where's my charging station here?
I love what I do. So I actually come out of my coaching sessions fueled up, because I work with great people and great leaders. But it took me a while, right? Okay. I am 25 years into my career before I found the thing that lights me up. So to me, I actually get so much energy of what I do. And that's amazing. And that's what I want for everybody. But when you are in a space where you might not be lit up by what you do, I do think it's important for you to actually spend some time unplugging, right? Because if it takes you a lot of energy and that get up and go, and we were talking about the Sunday night scaries, then you actually have to intentionally shut down and rest and recover. Yeah. So you have the space to do that. I would say that's number one. Number two, I would say, find a way, even in a small way, 10 minutes a day, to integrate back into your hobbies, right? What are the things that you do love doing that light you up? We were talking about my career coach telling me to get some hobbies and be interesting. So when I was on sabbatical, I took cooking classes. And when I was in college, I worked my way through college as a bartender. And so in the pandemic, I was on a, you know, sabbatical. I went back and I started doing cooking classes and started making really great meals and started making really great cocktails. Mm-hmm. There is creativity that came back. And through these process of filling my cup before my career could do it, I had a little bit more space and energy and ideas about the things that light me up that I can start to come and reapply to my career.
And then when you turn that around and go back in on Monday morning, you refresh, because you have you have gone to the charging station and the battery is full. So my way of looking at it is that I don't have any angst anymore. I can't wait to get up and do what I do. And sometimes I'll work 10, 12, 15, but I don't care, because I'm enjoying what I'm doing. And I say, if I, you know, when I look back and you know, you gauge your career, and you had the jobs and you were just doing it, 4:30, pack my stuff to get out. And whew, it's that way when I'm walking out. So I don't deal with that anymore. And so I also counsel people to say, you got to find that niche, you know, some kind of a way, because it opens up an entirely new world.
It does. I love that my therapist used to say, sometimes these warning signs are when you have the Sunday scaries or anxiety, it's like a check engine light, right? And I thought that this was such a beautiful analogy, because it's like, hey, it may not stop you in your tracks today, but if you keep ignoring and ignoring and ignoring the warning signals, one day you're not going to be able to get up and go, right? You were talking about the heart attacks on Monday morning, whether it's something like that, or whether you actually start to mentally start to check out and burn out and not be able to do what you used to do. So it's not, you know, I want everybody to be practical. I get it. People have jobs and families and bills, and you have to do what you have to do, but you should really think about prioritizing yourself. And really, I see sometimes a layoff, a forced stop. We talked about COVID. We've talked about layoffs. Sometimes a forced stopping in your tracks is an opportunity for you to not only rest, but to reflect and start to think about how can I integrate the things that do charge my battery into my career so I need less time on that proverbial charging station.
My doctor and I had a conversation when I was back in New York, and he told me that his wife, the light can come on. She still continues to drive. He said, I cannot tell you how many times the car has run out of gas. And when she got in that morning, it was the engine light was flat. The fuel light was flashing that you were almost on E, and she just ignores it. So, and what you said, if you don't do that, it could be have a detrimental effect in some way.
Yeah, it can, and it did for me, right? I have an article about burnout and my daughter catching me crying in the middle of the night. I got to the point when I was burned out, I was getting to work and I started just having pain. I didn't even know why. It just started hurting to walk, and I had leg and back pain. Nobody could find anything physically wrong with me. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And it was to the point where literally my medical team was like, you need to stop before something actually major and long-term happens, right? And so I talk about this great aha moment I had with my financial advisor where she was just like, what is your emergency fund for? And I was like, I don't know, a water leak, my car breaking down. She's like, but also you can't not break down. You need to stop and take a break. And that actually started to spur me into thinking differently about my work and what I'm passionate about and actually how I can design a career to suit my life as a parent. And I talk openly about divorce and being a single mom, right? I remember in COVID, I was home with my kids while working and they used to draw me pictures and slide them under my door. And I'm like, I am here with them and I'm still missing it. I'm still missing the moments and I'm still missing them growing up because I'm working 60 hours a week. Mm-hmm. Something has to give and change. What is the most important thing to me? And how can I design a life where I can have a really great, impactful career, but I can also be a really great, impactful mom? That's my goal. It may not be everybody's goal, no judgment, but that was my goal and my motivation.
So your daughter was sending, your kids were sending this through. That was it. That was them giving you the check engine light.
Yes. Right? Where are you?
We don't know the metaphor, but we need mom, and you're there with a door closed and you on Zoom.
Yeah. And it had me think differently about how I can show up for them. You know, one of the questions you asked is what motivates me? And, you know, for my kids, I have two girls, and to think about the challenges that I've faced as a Black woman, as a woman of color in the workplace, I don't want them to have the same challenges 20 years later. And it took me becoming a parent to realize I have to be the change that I want to see in the world. So not only do I want to fight for healthier, happier workplaces, I also have to model what that looks like for them. And having my daughter see me, watch me burn out, watch me take in toxic bosses, I was sending a message that it's okay to keep driving when the check engine light is on. Yeah. And it was a wake up call that that's not the message that I want to send.
Well, you know, a key point to that is that from the stories you tell is reflection, you know, which is big for me. You know, you reflect back, you reflect on the note that comes through the door. You reflect on a conversation with the kid. You reflect on the meeting that did not go well. And that's one of the tools I use at the end of every day. I reflect on that day. At the end of every week, I'll reflect on the week and how can I change it for the following week. But it's not work. I mean, it's just I enjoy doing that and picking out the spots that's not working and trying to do better next, because the next week is going to be something different anyway.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And, you know, as a coach, reflection is really key to the growth process. But I think to your earlier point, I don't know how many people are making time for reflection, right? And so I kind of want to go back to the earlier topic. How can we see a time where you might be in between jobs by force or by choice as a time for reflection, because very few people make meaning of the actual things that happen in their life. And those things our data, their information that we can apply so that we can hopefully all get to the place where you and I have arrived at, which is how can I still have a career? How can I support my lifestyle? And it doesn't feel like work.
Yeah. Jacob says that our brains find it hard to accept feedback, criticism, natural. As Coach Jeanette mentioned, it takes training. And what might help as well is the sandwich feedback. So that's the process of cool, not cool, cool.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like how you say that. You know, one of my favorites is, you know, the situation, you know, behavior and actual observation or what you want to do next, right? So also making sure it's clear and people receive that message. Because sometimes the sandwich, they're like, I heard good things, I can ignore the bad things, and I can kind of move on.
So, you know, I understand the concept, but if I don't make that clear, that person could walk away to say things are cool, because I picked up more on the cool part than I did on the areas that maybe need adjustment. So I love the concept of the so-called sandwich theory, but I want to maybe coach someone as to how to use that, because if I just kind of go through that from a, you know, from a structural perspective, I walk out of there, I'm thinking I've got it going on, and that's it.
And the other thing is, we don't want to also get people anxious that every time you say something good, they're bracing for the bad, because that's how you give feedback. I think kind of the positive, you know, reinforcement feedback should actually be on a whole separate wavelength from the developmental feedback of where I need you to get better. So people don't necessarily tie the two together, right? We should be filling the bank and giving that positive feedback and the wins on a regular basis and building that emotional bank account. It often takes 7 or 10 positive statements to kind of counteract a negative one.
Mm-hmm. John, thank you. John said this is the type of interview that makes your program so valuable. Thank you, John, for that stamp of approval, because John has a great show too on careers. John G. Self, you know, based out of Texas. So as we begin the process of closing down, and I thank you for getting up early to make this happen. Talk about, how did you become you? You know, what was important in your life growing up? So you grew up in the same town I live in. And so tell me about, what were some anchors in that growth process of coming up?
Yeah, I think one of the great anchors in the growth process, I would have to, you know, credit my dad. You know, most ideas that I had, he never thought were crazy or too ambitious. I was telling you in our pre-interview, you know, I want to be an engineer. I used to build buildings with Legos, right? And my dad always encouraged my dreaming, my creativity, my innovation, right? And so figuring out ways to reinvent myself without never having the self-talk to say, you know, no, that's too big, no, you can't do that, has been really helpful, informative. And I know that that is a very special gift. And I know that that's a special gift everybody does not have, especially sometimes from a parent. They might have some ideas about what it means for you to be successful and what they wanted for you. And they can have the best intent and it can still have a potential negative impact, right? And so some of the things that I help people coach with is, how do you get really in touch with those childhood dreams? And how can you start to find a way to integrate them? I believe, especially becoming a parent, we are who we are. And I see that really crisply in my daughters. And I appreciate what my parents gave to me. And what I'm trying to give to my kids is fiercely letting them and protecting who they are versus trying to change that idea. So I think, listen, go back to who you wanted to be when you grew up. What were your favorite toys? What were your favorite hobbies? How can you re-engage with those things to fill your cup? And what is that information telling you about the things that you want to bring forward into your present life?
You know, I do a lot of leadership development across the world, and that's one of the exercises we do, talk about important influences in your life. And it's always the father, mother, the grandfather, the aunt, someone there. Very seldom is it a manager or something like that. And that's like the grounding piece that they still, 20 years later, they're still talking about what that statement that their grandfather told them. And they still, that's the anchor that carries them through on those tough days. They go back to that.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like we need permission, right? As humans, we know we're afraid of rejection. So sometimes we need that permission to pursue the thing that we love and we hold so dear, right? Mm-hmm. And so hopefully you've gotten that somewhere in your origin story. Hopefully you will experience a great mentor or manager who can, you know, drive that in you. But it's also, don't be afraid to go seek out that inspiration and find it in yourself and build your team of people who are going to support and champion your dreams.
Wow. You know, one of the goals of the show is that we created this platform to talk with leaders and talk about their career journey and enriching experiences. That's one of the keys. We first started this series about talking all HR all the time. Nobody wants to hear that. But I find that, yeah, when people can share the nuggets that you share, and you really brought the A game today, and I hope you enjoyed being here. Is there any takeaways you would like to give the audience before we close down?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the takeaways that I have been saying and helping my leaders think about more lately is that candor is kind. You know, especially when we're having this tough time of companies closing, jobs being lost, things being transitioned, sometimes it can be really tempting to avoid the difficult conversations, right? And so I want to bring in having hard conversations, telling the truth about what is working and what's not working is actually kindness. The sooner that we can get to the point that something is not working, the sooner we can move on and start to reimagine what the opportunity and what the future is. So I just want everybody to start to lean into the tough conversations. Being honest, being transparent is actually a form of kindness. It's a form of love. And I want people to go build that muscle and flex the muscle to share that candor.
Jeanette, thank you so much.
Ron, thank you so much. Always good to meet a neighbor halfway around the world.
Yeah, I'm still there. So let's stay in touch. I'll send you an email following up from here. So thank you so much for being a guest, and we'll talk later.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.